The deliberate and systematic killing of a group of people, whether for racial, political, religious, ethnic, or nationalist reasons, it's called genocide. It's about as savage a crime as human beings are capable of. But sometimes oppressors find it works nearly as well to keep bodies, but deliberately and systematically destroy the cultures that animate souls. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The term for that crime is ethnocide. It was coined by the same scholar who introduced the word genocide to the lexicon as the Nazis were carrying out their brutal campaign. Ethnocide didn't catch on in the same way, but my guest wants us to know and understand what it means, because without language to describe atrocities, we may struggle to recognize and end them. Barrett Holmes-Pittner is a columnist, journalist, philosopher, and founder of the Sustainable Culture Lab. His book is called The Crime Without a Name, Ethnocide and the Erasure of Culture in America. Barrett, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So this book is about your worry that our society lacks the language to describe its own flaws and abuses of power. So if we can't easily talk about our problems, it becomes impossible to fix them?
100%. Yeah, if you can't articulate anything, then it becomes hard to communicate the problem to other people, to have the necessary discussions and practices to combat it. So if you can't say it, then it's hard to do the subsequent next steps to change it.
As I mentioned, the term ethnocide was coined by the same person who gave us the term genocide. Tell us a little bit about Raphael Lemkin and how his life experiences helped inform his work.
So Raphael Lemkin was a Polish Jewish man, and his life experiences it's fascinating because when you think of Europe around the time in the early 20th century, a lot was in flux. And so growing up in his part of Poland, at one part, it was Russian influence in his culture, but also German. And so he was kind of in this fascinating intersection of European cultures and perspectives and philosophies. And I think that really shaped his life quite a bit, just geographically being in that environment. And so then when he went to school, he wanted to become a lawyer, but he always had a sensitivity to the crimes being inflicted upon people throughout the world. And as a Jewish person in Europe, his culture was receiving that abuse before the Holocaust. You know, the pogroms that the Russians were engaging in really made him aware of these types of atrocities that could befall people. And so he wanted to become a lawyer to help prevent these types of these crimes, which at the time didn't really have a name. And so his lived experiences in a really volatile part of the world and his just innate empathy shaped, who he became and his work. And so when World War II started, he recognized quite early that he needed to get out, that there, that this was going to be quite bad. And so he fled the country and he came to the United States, and he was fortunate enough to be able to do so because as a celebrated lawyer, he made connections with Americans. He was able to get a job at Duke University. And so he was able to immigrate to the U.S. because he had these connections due to his stature, his status as a, fairly well-respected lawyer. And when he got to the U.S., he worked to raise awareness of what was happening to Jewish people during the Holocaust, during World War II. And a lot of Americans just didn't really believe that that was the case. They didn't think that Germany, which was a really vibrant cultural epicenter of European society, was capable of engaging of a crime of that severity. And so that's when it dawned on him that to make people aware of what was happening, maybe he needed to coin a new word. And one of the fascinating things about Lemkin is since he was born in an area where there's just so many different languages going on, there's Russian, Polish, German, right in his area, he had a proficiency with languages. I believe he learned about 5 to 6 languages and was, was passable in about 12. And so this love and familiarity with language, I think, emboldened him to believe he could make a word, and he could make a word by combining, languages to make a new word. And so genocide is part Greek and Latin, and so is ethnocide. And so there's just so much of his life that made him aware of the horrors happening in the world, but also gave him the language to articulate it. I think one of the sadder parts is as he came to the United States, he came here to, get safety and security from Germany. But once he started talking about genocide, the US and a lot of the international community was really resistant to his work. And so he didn't get success and acclaim in the US. If he was relatively like a pretty impoverished person for the remainder of his life in the United States. And I think that's also like a warning where some, sometimes the greatest people, especially in a place like the United States, which in my book I describe as ethnocidal, the society may not embrace the people during their lifetime, and we only really start appreciating their work long after we've, the society has tried to silence it for quite a long time.
So, when you describe the United States as an ethnocidal society, this has been used in this country to privilege the lives and the experiences of European colonizers and their descendants over pretty much everybody else. Talk about some forms this has taken over time.
So, I'd say a pretty modern example is gentrification. So, gentrification is a really simple way of talking about ethnocide in the current state, in that, like, when you have an ethnocidal society, so, like, if you're going to engage in ethnocide, which in the book I talk about it via the transatlantic slave trade, because the goal of that was to get African people and systematically destroy their culture, but keep the physical bodies to then create a system of chattel slavery in the US. So the goal is to have people that you can, that are within reach, so that you can exploit and oppress forever via destroying their culture. So if you're going to start creating cities, those cities are going to be based on division, because you have to, the ethnocider, the person engaging in ethnocide, is going to need to have access to the people that they're going to oppress. And if those people are really far away, then you won't have access to them. So cities will get built where a dividing line will be like the defining aspect of the city. And so what happens now is this division is just interwoven in so many American cities, and we've created structures where the areas of cities are valued based off of property rights and all sorts of financial components that financially exist to kind of like sustain division, where like you have to have X amount of money to be able to live in this area, and the other area doesn't have that much money. Government funds are not being allocated to that space. So what ends up happening is a lot of white Americans will get priced out of their own community. Like, the property values will go up, and the next generation won't be able to afford to live in that area. And so then they're just, going to look for an affordable place to live. And that place that they'll look to live will be the area that they've been exploiting for generations. It's right next door. The housing's really affordable. The buildings, aren't that bad. The African American community has spent a lot of time making this place livable despite getting very little support from the government. And then a white person will move into that area, and they're not going to necessarily going to be malicious, or have like, evil intent, but they're going to go in there without the narrative or the philosophy of trying to be a part of that culture. They're going to view it as like, I'm coming in here, and this is a transaction. This is a cultureless way of flowing through the world. And so they'll disrupt that community. They'll disrupt that culture. They won't try to be a part of it. And this is where the tension and gentrification comes, where it's not a race thing per se. It's not that someone says, I don't like someone for the color of their skin. They don't like how they interact with the people that live in that community. And so this is the tension of gentrification, where if African Americans who have been oppressed for, the beginning of the United States have spent a lot of time investing in an area that has gotten very little funding from the government, and then someone shows up and they don't want to be a part of that community, and they act like they're better because they can bring more funds in or something like that, and that's going to cause tension. And I think that's a really like casual, just everyday manifestation of ethnocide, where you destroy somebody's culture. And then once those people get priced out of that community, they can't move far away because the jobs are still mostly going to be in the white part of town. And so then it creates like a cycle of displacement, where you get moved from one area, you go a little further out. The next thing you know, that one area that is getting gentrified, the values of that go up. The next generation can't afford to live there. They go to the next area where African Americans have relocated to. that displacement happens again, and then just the cycle continues forever, and we never have a dynamic where you can like live without casually displacing other people and disrupting people's culture and community.
In this book, Barrett, you point out that for a society that likes to think of itself as founded on principles of freedom and representative democracy, we have a lot of weird ways of talking about ourselves and our fellow Americans. For example, using the word consumers where we could probably just use citizens. How does something like that feed and reinforce destructive ideas about it, what it means to be a real American?
Oh, yeah. So consumers is like, that's not a productive, sustainable way to view yourself or other people. Like, consumption is a narrative that there's something out there that you can just consume and take and it'll replenish itself. Like, that right there is just exploitative at a foundational level. Like, you're not creating anything. You're not sustaining anything. You are just here taking something from something else that will live unnamed. And so, like, ethnocide, clearly prior to this book, had been largely unnamed. And so, you know, what they're going to be consuming in an ethnocidal society is going to be the culture of somebody else. It's going to be somebody else is going to be required in order to sustain, like, another group. So if you look at, like, a good example would be, like, childcare. Or even during the pandemic, when the people who were regarded as the essential workers largely did jobs that more affluent white people were dependent on. You know, they were like the cleaners, they were the people taking care of children, they were, you know, the garbage people, all that kind of stuff that you need at the expense of somebody else, where you're just consuming the environment, you're consuming other people, you're consuming. And you're not sharing, you're not cultivating, you're not creating, you're not nurturing each other. And so when we have language that's very problematic and we just look at it as if it isn't, then we sustain a culture that is destructive. You can't just live by consuming. You have to cultivate and create and nurture and sustain.
Barrett, it's easy to assume, if we're not paying close attention, that the American way of looking at things is, if not universal, universally aspired to. But there are so many other cultures that organize themselves around different values and assumptions. What is the Dutch concept described by the word polderen?
I love this. So the Dutch culture idea around polderen means reclaim land. Essentially. And so the Netherlands, a large part of it's below sea level. And so for about 1,000 years, what the Dutch have been doing is reclaiming that land. So they will create dams and dikes and windmills and canals and stuff to push out the water of the North Sea so that that land that's above the water, you know, below the water will, you know, emerge. What this does, though, is it also creates like a pretty precarious situation where if there's a big storm or some, you know, the windmill malfunctions or the canal has a leak, that land that's their home, all of it could go away. And so this reclamation of the land created a unified culture where everyone that lives on that land knows that no matter what, they have to come together to sustain the land, to sustain their existence. So whatever your political views are, your religious views are, what, you know, if you don't like your neighbor, all of that has to get put to the side if something happens and we have to maintain the land. And so this creates a culture of togetherness, of tolerance. And this is quite unique in a lot, and, you know, throughout Europe, I'd say. It's not a coincidence that the Dutch were known as some of the most tolerant parts of Europe where, you know, people of different religious views could live there. And this appreciation for the land shapes so many aspects of Dutch life where, you know, if you're going to bring the land from below the sea back above it, you're going to value every inch of that land. Like, you're not going to bring it up and then waste it, neglect it. So the Dutch have become really efficient at at farming and making sure that they don't use pesticides because, you know, they will make that farm, it'll be right next to a school and where people live. You want to make sure that there aren't toxins in that that get in the water that then harm children. And so there's a very, very real efficiency and sustainability to how they go about stuff, which began with this practice of, you know, creating polders by moving the water out, and then that creating a togetherness that I think is really can be inspirational to other societies where if you need a word, you know, language to talk about togetherness and an example of how it can be beneficial. And this isn't to say that, you know, poldering is perfect in every single regard or whatever, but it is to say that this is a template. This is language you can use to advocate for stronger communities, sustainable culture, and especially right now when it comes to climate change, where lots of people are actually tragically having to deal with these issues that the Dutch have confronted for about 1,000 years. And then this can also be a narrative for promoting togetherness in a time of, you know, environmental crisis and rising sea levels and whatnot.
You note that in the United States, many white people define themselves as white without any founding connection to a place or collective sense of being one people. How does that perception set us up to commit ethnocide against others who may feel connected to a place or as a people?
So, you know, America in many ways is it's tries to exist as an idea. This country is an idea that doesn't have a profound attachment to the place. And whiteness is one of those ideas. So once Europeans left Europe, the focus became, you know, more on the aesthetics and less on the physical place in which they live. You know, the emphasis was less about whether you are French or Spanish or English, and more about what you look like, this idea of looking white and that being something that's more important than looking some other way. And if your identity is forged in making sure that you look European while never living in Europe and being surrounded by non-European stuff, that's going to create an identity that doesn't want to equitably interact with anything, essentially. You know, like the environment that's here will become something that you don't want to interact with unless it maybe generates wealth for you or something. But you will be less inclined to equitably interact with African people, Asian people, indigenous people, because that mixing that may occur over due to equitably interacting with one another could then make you no longer look European, and now your whiteness could go away forever, and now your identity would be gone. I think that's a very real fear for a lot of white people in this country now, and especially in the past. And so that attachment to an idea of whiteness that like that's more significant, it's an essence that's more that you perceive as more significant than your attachment to the place in which you live and the people around you, and sustainable nurturing practices can definitely make people more inclined to engage in ethnocide and division and terror and all sorts of harm towards other people because they feel that harm and terror is something that they have to do to sustain that white essence, that aesthetic, that physical appearance.
A number of seminal Black American thinkers have been deeply affected by travels outside the United States. I mean, just to name two, you write here about Malcolm X going to Mecca. Many people know about James Baldwin's years in France. What changed when you went overseas for the first time with regard to your own understanding of how American ethnocide essentially collapses the nuances of Blackness and a Black identity?
Yeah, wonderful question. And so in sixth grade, my middle school gave us the option of like picking a language that we could study. And the Spanish class wasn't going anywhere for like a trip. They weren't going anywhere. And the French class was going to France at the end of eighth grade. And at this stage, I already knew like I needed to get out of America, not like as an escape, but just I needed to be able to see the rest of the world because I was not impressed by America in the slightest. I just need to see something else. And so I got a job refereeing soccer matches in middle school so I could afford this trip. And I went to France in eighth grade for 2 weeks. And I loved it. It was a wonderful time. But there was a moment there when I experienced racism pretty acutely. I was going to the post office. I was getting a postcard to send back to my parents, and my French wasn't that good, but I'm there practicing, trying to be good. So I go to the post office and I'm at the front desk and I'm trying to tell the woman behind the counter that I would like to send this postcard, home to my family. And the lady is just saying no, quite stern. She's just saying she's not going to send this postcard. And I really don't know what's going on. I'm just wonder. I assumed my French has been really bad or something. So I turned back to my host mother, because on this trip we stayed with a family, and I told her I didn't, what was going on. My host mother gets there and she explains to this woman that I'm an American person. I'm not an African person. That I'm an American coming to France to learn French. I'm on a school trip. And at this point, the woman at the post office just apologizes profusely. She is, "Oh, I'm so sorry." And so she then takes my postcard and I can send it back home. And at that point, it really hit me that in America, black is it's aesthetics. You just, if you look it, you are it. And that means that you get, you're susceptible to the type of abuse that has happened to black people in the United States. There's no real concern as to where you culturally are from. There's no real distinction. It's color-based. It's just, that's what it is. But in France, it wasn't exclusively color-based. It wasn't good, but it hit me. Like, this person was nice to me when she realized I was American, because she's not doesn't dislike people because of the color of their skin. She disliked them from where they were from, and they may have that color of skin in that place. And I'm like, wow, there's a nuance here that's not like positive, but it's different than in America. It made it so, in a weird way, that I could be treated more like a person in France, because they're like, oh, you're of the people that we've decided that we like. And that just blew my mind. It's not, clearly it's not indicative of France being like the greatest place. Racism is still bad in all the different manifestations, but it made it really clear to me of how different it was there than it was here. There were like nuances, different shades to it being bad.
The United States has notoriously engaged in genocide against indigenous peoples in this country. How has our government also tried to force native peoples to abandon their cultures?
Oh, well, the residential school program, that's big in Canada, but they also did in the US. At a certain point, the United States and the Canadian government kind of concluded that they couldn't systematically wipe out all indigenous people. And so they articulated that they had an Indian problem, and that Indian problem was that they existed. And so if they couldn't get them from existing, what they could do is try to destroy indigenous culture and then teach them how to be Western. That is ethnocide. It was kind of like they chose ethnocide once they believed that genocide was no longer on the table. And so the whole indoctrination of trying to, as the Carlyle school said, they wanted to kill the Indian and save the man, was an agenda of destroying indigenous culture and forcing them to be Westernized people. And I think, that's ethnocide. There's not really any other way to get around it. And so there's been many, many manifestations of that. And if you even look at, oh, man, the indigenous people, it's always a combination of a genocidal campaign and an ethnocidal one. And so there's, you can look at reservations as kind of like a slow erasure, where the culture is getting squeezed, where they can't actively engage in their culture, but also they're being starved of resources. And so then they're slowly, like the population's dwindling. That's like a mixture of the two. But I'd say the most overt ethnocidal agenda has been these re-education camps, essentially, where they tried to destroy indigenous culture and force upon them Western culture. And Canada had the residential school program longer than the United States did. And, you know, those many schools in Canada that they have been reexamining, and they find, you know, the remains of indigenous children, and they're trying to figure out ways to compensate indigenous peoples for the trauma that these schools, these programs have caused. That's ethnocide.
Barrett, how is a question like, where are you from, often a tool of ethnocide?
Yeah, so it's a tool of ethnocide because the idea of being a part of American culture in many ways is, do you have the idea of like European whiteness to a certain extent? And so when you ask someone where you're from, people are going to take it, people that have immigrated to the United States are going to take it as an affront because they spent a lot of time adapting to the culture here and trying to become a part of it. Like if you move to someplace, the proper thing to do is learn the culture and try to become a part of it, try to be a nurturing, sustainable member of it. And if you've gone through this work that frankly takes generations, and the fact that you don't look like you're European means that people are inclined to ask where you're from. And they oftentimes aren't asking where you're from because they want to learn about a foreign culture. It's not that they're really curious about the place. They just want to kind of classify your like non-Americanness just so they have like a catalog of how you're not American. That right there is a continuation of ethnocide, because what people are trying to do is create and become part of the culture here, and then they find out there actually isn't, that the culture here is an idea, an aesthetic, it's an essence. It's not based on your existence. It's not based on your effort. It's based on how people see you. And if that vision, that aesthetic, is attached to this European Western idea of what is and isn't good, that becomes an affront. You know, there's so many different nuances to this where are you from question that manifest if you're of any ethnicity that's not white, where there's like a stripping of your humanity because they don't really care about how you're existing in the world. They care more about the idea, the essence of what they think someone who looks like you should be, opposed to what you actually are.
Let's talk about this. You write about our culture prioritizing essence before existing. Explain that concept for us.
Yeah, so the concept came from René Descartes, and it's, if you look at just his basic phrase, the phrase everyone loves, I think, therefore I am, that phrase prioritizes your thinking, confirms your existence. So therefore, your thoughts precede your existence. And so your thoughts can be anything. And in a European philosophical like language way, they just call that essence. And so your essence can be, it can be anything, you know, and an essence isn't a bad thing. It's just if you value that more than existence, then you've given yourself a justification for all sorts of destruction. Like that can be very, very problematic. And so for the longest time, because, you know, René Descartes, his Cartesian philosophy was like the birth of Western philosophy after the Dark Ages. You know, he was the pinnacle of the Enlightenment. Well, once World War I and World War II happened and these various European essences were fighting amongst each other and had the potential of wiping Europe off the map, existentialism became a big philosophical idea. And Jean-Paul Sartre, his idea of existentialism put existence before essence, where your existence mattered more than your essence, more than your ideas. And that's really, really, that just flips everything on its head. And so if you look at the United States, you know, this country was created by European ideas far before existentialism even existed. And so this society is all based around essence. It's all ideas. The United States, we celebrate that we're an idea. You know, we're an idea of freedom. We're an idea of this, an idea of that. And that somehow makes us better than these other places that just exist in the world. That's European philosophy. At the same time, when colonizers showed up here, they had the idea that they were better than other people. And that idea trumped the existence of all these people. It trumped reality. It allowed them to feel they could do whatever they wanted because their idea justified it. They could exist within their delusions forever. And their delusions justified all their actions because existence is just a secondary thing.
So walk us through some of the steps we need to take to dismantle ethnocide as it exists in this country.
Western society doesn't have a word that means good place. We have the word utopia, but utopia actually means non-existent good place. And so linguistically, we have a word that means non-existent good place and then a word that means bad place and dystopia. And so we're linguistically impaired of even articulating creating a good place or sustaining or nurturing a good place, because a good place is just something that's imagined that you get to and it's already there and you just kind of get to passively live within it. No, we have to create a good place. And so that you have to have a philosophy about what goodness is and the actions that are good, because ethnocide is clearly bad. So if you want to stop it, you have to have a philosophy of what, like, proactively doing good, what that is. And so in the book, I introduced the word evtopia, which means sustainable, nurturing, good place. And so this now creates another language where you can talk to people about doing evtopian things or creating an evtopia and, you know, having an evtopian environment in your house where you're interacting with people, where you say, my philosophy, why I'm here, is I'm trying to make a sustainable, nurturing place. That doesn't mean I'm going to be perfect every single time, but at least you know what I'm intentionally trying to do. And we can collaboratively work towards that. That's a great way for countering ethnocide.
Barrett Holmes-Pittner is a columnist, journalist, philosopher, and founder of the Sustainable Culture Lab. His book is called The Crime Without a Name, Ethnocide and the Erasure of Culture in America. Barrett, this has been really interesting. Thanks very much for making time to talk.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram by searching for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.